Greetings and celebrations, my excellent listeners, and welcome to this June 2012 Science News Update. I'm your host for this highly polished jewel of a science podcast, Jim Campanella. To quote that famous song, school's out for summer. Maybe now I can get enough sleep each night to function every day. I am greatly pleased. Anyway, now that I'm getting all rested up, you are going to get something that you have not heard in a while. An editorial. Nay, even a rant. This particular issue has gotten my blood stirred up over the last few months, but it finally came to a head after reading an article excerpt from a book called Bunch of Amateurs by writer Jack Hitt. The excerpt was published in the magazine Popular Science in their latest issue. This story is perhaps one of the scariest things I've ever read in my entire life, perhaps even more scary than a Jersey Shore episode. So, who are these amateurs, and what was the terrifying story about? Well, it was about the new trend of amateurs doing genetic engineering in their garages and kitchens. I suspect the response of most of you is, meh. Now, if I had said amateurs doing nuclear engineering in their homes, you would have felt a distinct chill go up your spine. But when you say they are doing amateur biology in their homes, you think of Ben Franklin or some other 18th or 19th century scientist, and think, ooh, that's very quaint, isn't it? Science in the home. How nice. Whereas when I think of home molecular biologists, I think of the Andromeda strain or the movie Contagion. I do not think how quaint. I think this is a seriously bad idea. The article concerns a woman whose brilliant concept is to make glow-in-the-dark yogurt by transferring the green fluorescent protein gene into lactobacilli. Lactobacilli are the bacteria that make yogurt. Why? Because it's fun! Like building a radio-controlled toilet or something, I guess. She gets nowhere, by the way, and the writer of the article spends days with her in a fruitless pursuit of this goal. The level of ignorance is rampant in the article, with the wrong use of terminology, the incorrect application of technology, and a misunderstanding of some basic principles of biology, molecular biology, and genetics. But all that can actually be forgiven. The scientist here does not have a doctorate in biology, nor does she even have a bachelor's degree in biology. She's a computer programmer. I suspect that no one ever explained to her that plasmid species specificity and cell transformation competency are both required for the process of transformation to be successful. But that is understandable. Sorry to get esoteric on you. This woman is a newbie. I learned lab technique and why things work and don't work, both practically in laboratories over 19 years of undergraduate, master's, doctoral, and postdoctoral training, as well as from the theoretical end in lectures and seminars. And yes, that level of training is standard for anybody who does genetic engineering as a profession. So certainly all the newbie mistakes that are discussed in the article are understandable, and will be made by most people picking up their knowledge just from books. There are some places where being an autodidact is pointless and even harmful. I've had discussions with my martial arts sensei about people thinking they can learn martial arts from books. They go to the library, get a book on Kung Fu or Aikido, or get a video out. And after a couple of chapters or a few minutes of watching, they are suddenly Bruce Lee. There is too much subtlety to martial arts, too much a book does not explain or a video does not show to expect to learn a subtle skill in such a fashion. It is even very dangerous if you walk into a bar and pick a fight as a self-taught karate guy or gal. Anyone would agree that that is just plain stupid. Well, self-taught molecular biology is no less stupid. The sheer audacity that this woman and her friends have, who are playing at being scientists and inventors, is frightening. They're like children playing with matches. If they can make the flames at all, they are completely ignorant of the safety concerns of having those flames around. I do not begrudge anyone having a hobby, but some hobbies are just plain bloody dangerous. If I decided to try my hand at nuclear fusion as a hobby in my garage, the U.S. government would step in and tell me to cease and desist and possibly arrest me, certainly confiscate all my equipment. Apparently, the U.S. government has either not yet seen the danger involved here with home genetic tinkering or is choosing to ignore it until something horrendous occurs. What am I worried about? Well, back in the 1970s, when genetic engineering was first beginning, the safety of making transgenic organisms terrified scientists. There were meetings and conferences all around the world to come up with guidelines that define exactly what we do with transgenic organisms and how we dispose of said organisms. The most famous of these meetings took place in 1975 at the Sylmar Conference Center in California. This conference established the pattern of American policy for controlling the field of molecular biology safety and served as an influential precedent for policy making abroad as well for the next 40 years afterwards. Dr. Susan Wright, a science historian from the University of Michigan, has written about the Sylmar meeting and its conclusions. Quote, "In order to move ahead with genetic engineering, the Sylmar scientists proposed a bargain with society, restrictions on their research in exchange for self-governance. They made the bargain palatable to the wider public by making it appear natural. Scientists were uniquely qualified to understand the problem and develop a solution. Rational, scientists were making a sacrifice and were therefore responsible, and universal, everyone would reap the benefits. And by marginalizing problems like the prospect of novel biological weapons or genetically engineered humans that clearly fell outside the scope of scientific ingenuity to address at the time." Unquote. By the way, lots of scientists at that Sylmar meeting called for complete bans on genetic engineering, but the majority decided that the technology was too valuable, too important, and too promising to just lay aside. The end result is that my work is restricted and controlled by the government. We have safety regulations for creation and disposal of transgenic organisms that I learned in the cradle as an undergraduate. As a reward for 19 years of training, I have free access to buying equipment, enzymes, chemicals, etc. that can be used in very dangerous ways if I were to decide to go all David Bruce Banner and do whatever research I like and damn the consequences. But I have kept the faith, as 99.9% of my colleagues have, and not gone completely rogue. Yes, an amateur has neither the funding nor the access to the same quality of equipment, chemicals, and cultures that I have. But why is the U.S. government not watching these people and shutting them down? They are going to cause a catastrophic event simply by their sheer ignorance. Not even malice is needed to dispose of something the wrong way and allow it to get into the general environment. Note that I am not even addressing terrorism, which could blossom in an environment where amateur genetic engineers are allowed to do whatever they like in their basements. Oh, what might a terrorist do? Well, besides weaponizing a flu virus, which has been in the news now for the last couple of months, they could cause all sorts of horrendous havoc. For instance, well, back in the 1970s, Dr. Paul Berg of Stanford University contemplated putting tumor virus DNA into a common E. coli. E. coli is ubiquitous, literally everywhere. Imagine such a common bacteria causing a tumor epidemic. It would be devastating. But that is not what I am thinking about. I am actually ignoring the people who would actively do others harm. I am talking about those poor schmucks who, through their sheer ignorance, will create some horror that gets loosed in the world. Perhaps my apprehension is unfounded, but the entire point of this biopunk or biomaker or genome hacking movement, as they've all been called, just seems so frivolous. The Pop Science article kept comparing this new trend to hacking electronics, like how Apple was founded and how the home computer was invented. The author believes that major technological breakthroughs are going to arise from this backyard tinkering, like glow-in-the-dark yogurt, I suppose, or, I love this one, trees that grow your own furniture or sheets of paper. These tinkerers are trying their hands seriously at all manner of genetic engineering. It is just not the same thing as the garage movement that started the creation of home computers. Steve Wozniak and company did not potentially threaten lives by building computers in their garages. And one of the things that irks me the most is apparently when big companies and universities produce genetically modified organisms and then spend years in testing those GMOs. That is scary and must be regulated closely. But when common citizens do it, well, that's okay then. Am I missing something here? Where is the public hue and cry? Why is it that the blue rose that was genetically engineered 2 years ago by a Japanese company is still in GMO testing limbo. But these dangerous newbies are running around with nobody watching over them. I asked one of my colleagues that question, and he suggested that perhaps the government is not legislating against these amateurs because they are waiting for something terrible to happen first. If something tragic comes from their tinkering, then the government will come down on them, and probably train scientists and academics as well, like a ton of bricks, with new and onerous regulations. I was not sure how to respond to that hypothesis, but all I can say is that I hope it's not true. I want to believe that somebody in charge is going to do something before it all blows up in our faces. Okay, enough. If I go on much longer with this, I'll pop an aneurysm. Let's actually cover a couple of science stories. We do not want to make this a one-note segment. First off, if you are around in 4 billion years, you will find our home galaxy, the Milky Way, may be in for some serious trouble. Astronomers at the Space Telescope Institute in Baltimore report in the upcoming issue of the journal Astrophysical Journal that in 4 billion years, the Milky Way is going to collide with the Andromeda Galaxy. The Hubble telescope shows that the two galaxies are headed for an exact collision course with each other. No glancing blows involved. By precisely locating the same stars in Andromeda in 2002 and then again in 2010, the astronomers have calculated how the galaxy has moved against the background of deep space. Andromeda is 2.5 million light-years away and is closing in on the Milky Way at about 250,000 miles an hour. That sounds pretty fast, except when you're talking in intergalactic terms. The cosmic collision will transform the heavens into a swirl in 4 billion years. The galaxies will pass by each other, and then, by 5 billion years, be drawn back together to form one supersized galaxy. Calculations suggest that the Sun will be tossed out of its present location and shuttled around during this galactic mashup to drift erratically in the eventual single large galaxy that will coalesce from the two. The scientists have also suggested that the Earth and solar system will not be affected in the collision, according to their models. This sounds all too much to me like the scenario from Space 1999, except that it's not just the moon being pushed out of its present location. Okay, next story. Giant insects. Millions of years ago, insects were huge. They could be as big as good-sized birds, a la the insects in Peter Jackson's King Kong movie from a couple of years ago. It has been hypothesized that we no longer have huge insects because millions of years ago the concentration of oxygen in the air was much higher, and it is now much lower. Insects do not have lungs and take large amounts of air into their bodies. Instead, they use a rather inefficient way that limits their size if there's not a lot of oxygen in the air. Well, that's what everyone believed. But apparently there's another reason why huge insects died out. Early birds. Dr. Matthew Clapham, a paleontologist at the University of California, writes about the titanic struggle between birds and insects in a new article in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. The epic struggle between birds and insects ended an era of insect growth spurts that coincided with big increases in the amount of oxygen in the air. Starting with the Cretaceous period, predators kept the sizes of insects down. Clapham says, quote, "Even though oxygen continued to increase during that time, the insects got smaller. That's when birds evolved and started to become better at flying. They got so good at flying and predating insects that the larger insects were wiped out," unquote. To work out oxygen's effects on prehistoric insects, Clapham examined more than 10,000 fossils from the last 320 million years. He compared changes in maximum size over time to changes in atmospheric oxygen. Apparently, Clapham's work is the most comprehensive data set to examine oxygen and size to date. Small insects were ubiquitous throughout the fossil record he examined, but the biggest of the big insects enlarged when oxygen levels rose and shrank when oxygen levels fell. About 300 million years ago, dragonflies had wings comparable to the size of those of a heron. At that time, oxygen made up more than 30% of the atmosphere. Today, oxygen levels are at about 21%, so it's about a 9% difference. The largest insects shrank as the oxygen levels declined during the Triassic and Jurassic period. However, there were still locust-like jumping bugs called titanoperans that boasted wingspans of up to 36 centimeters, or over a foot for the Americans listening. Then 150 million years ago, giant insects disappeared, even though oxygen levels had started to rise again. One explanation for the insects' failure to regain their former glory is that an avian revolution had begun. Creatures like Archaeopteryx gave way to birds with greater maneuverability. Advanced bird body plans featured smaller wings, specialized wing bones that were very light, and giant breastbones to help flap wings. Clapham concludes that the new and better feathered friends devoured the oversized bugs, putting them out of their misery and making them extinct. Clapham suggests another possibility is that the giant insects may have died out simply by being outcompeted by the birds who were better hunters. The giants were pushed out of their predatory niche and just starved to death when they couldn't get enough bugs to eat. The next story of the evening concerns animal honesty. Most of the time, being honest has its advantages to animals. Animals use signals such as complex coloring or ornamentation to convey information to other animals about their fighting ability or their value as a mate. Clear signals can save time and energy for animals. For example, mismatched rivals can avoid a risky duel if they can communicate their fighting ability, and the weaker opponent can cede to the stronger one and just get out of dodge. Dr. Simon Leveaux and company from the University of New Orleans have just published a scientific report this month in the Proceedings of the Royal Society, which examines honesty in green lizards. I know that sounds a bit far-fetched, but just stay with me. Leveaux wonders why exactly an animal would be dishonest with another animal. It's generally better to be viewed by other animals as being a better mate or bigger and nastier. He even brings up something which is called the handicap hypothesis by biologists, which I've always found amusing. The hypothesis basically states that there is a cost to being too honest in your communication. The best example of this phenomenon used by animal biologists is the tail of the peacock. This lavish adornment is so cumbersome that only strong males can haul around an impressive tail and still escape from predators. So having that beautiful and heavy tail indicates that you are the peacock equivalent of a badass. Leveaux put the handicap hypothesis to the test in a unique way using green anole lizards. The green anole is an excellent subject for such a study, as male green anoles signal to each other with a brightly colored dewlap. The dewlap is a flap of skin beneath the jaw that they can extend and retract. A big dewlap is an honest signal that they have a nasty bite force and are excellent fighters. Here's an important point, though. The dewlap is unrelated to the muscles surrounding the jaw that generate the bite force, so it's possible for the two traits to vary independently from one another. It's possible, for example, for the lizard to have a big dewlap and a weak jaw, and vice versa. And that was pretty much the basis of the study. Leveaux and his colleagues investigated whether food restriction would change the honest relationship between dewlap size and bite force. He predicted that if the handicap hypothesis was correct, and the cost of maintaining the bright dewlap maintains the honesty of the signal, then food restriction should limit both dewlap size and bite force. The question is, when the times are tough, do the lizards stay honest? That is, do they still develop the bright dewlaps to indicate a badassness which they no longer possess? To answer the question, the authors captured juvenile male green anoles and raised them to sexual maturity in the lab, under either food-restricted or plentiful diets. In the end, both dewlap size and bite force were measured. The authors found that while lizards with plenty of food developed the typically honest relationship between dewlap size and bite force, the food-restricted males developed the bright dewlaps without developing the corresponding bite force. "Aha, j'accuse, you are a most dishonest lizard." Sorry. So, food-deprived lizards were not as honest as their food-rich counterparts. Additionally, it appears that for green anoles, bite force itself is more costly than the bright dewlap signal. So what is controlling the production of a big dewlap? Leveaux suggests the possibility that social feedback might play an important role. In Leveaux's study, lizards were raised apart and did not interact with one another. But in the wild, exaggerating about bite force with a bright dewlap might land a lizard in a fight where he's overmatched and could be injured. While more research is necessary to fully understand the factors that maintain honest communication signals, it seems that, for lizards at least, honesty is the best policy. Like those self-taught martial artists I mentioned earlier, the lizard's dishonesty may make them more dangerous to themselves than to any attacker. Last story of the night. Apparently, Prozac and like antidepressants have an effect on cells, even when they are not part of a nervous system. Dr. Ethan Perlstein of Princeton University, from just down the road here, has just published a study in the journal PLOS ONE, which describes the effects of Zoloft and Prozac on single-celled eukaryotes. Yeast cells don't make the brain chemical serotonin, or have brains for that matter, but that doesn't stop the single-celled fungus from responding to antidepressant. Zoloft and Prozac are part of a class of antidepressants called selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. These drugs are thought to boost mood by increasing the levels of serotonin floating around between nerve cells, because depression may have its cause as low levels of the neurotransmitter. Both drugs latch onto a molecule called the serotonin transporter, which sits on the outside of nerve cells and slurps up serotonin. By gumming up the serotonin transporter, they leave more free serotonin to stimulate nerve endings and, well, make you happier. Perlstein says, quote, "A molecule like Zoloft should be completely innocuous to a yeast cell, in the way that an antibiotic would be innocuous to a viral infection," unquote. But when Perlstein and his team gave the cells a low dose of Zoloft, the drug accumulated inside membranes that surround the cell's organelles and the yeast itself. The drug buildup distorted the normal curvature of the membranes and seemed to trigger a quality control check in which the cells started breaking themselves down. This is a process called autophagy. In short, the cells digested and destroyed themselves. This might be a little scary for anybody taking these drugs long-term or even short-term, but Perlstein says it's unknown whether a similar process happens in human cells. It's also not clear whether the process would be harmful or helpful to brain cells if it occurred. Autophagy, literally self-eating in Latin, could trigger some beneficial changes. If so, the results might eventually enhance scientists' understanding of how drugs like Zoloft work. Perlstein also says that antidepressants sometimes can take weeks to kick in, suggesting that a complex process is at work. It has been a mystery why they don't start working immediately for a long time. He says, quote, "You cannot simply talk about this as a serotonin thing. You cannot dismiss the activity of these molecules in systems and cells that don't have serotonin. It's telling you that something else is going on," unquote. The article also points out that yeast are very different from human cells and have very different membranes. Additionally, they point out that epidemiological data indicates that these medications are among the safest that we have ever had in the treatment of mental illness. Still, personally, I find that the effect on yeast cells is kind of scary. It reminds me of the first scene of the new movie Prometheus with the space jockey at the waterfall. Even though it's the first 5 minutes of the movie and not really a spoiler, I will not say more about it. If you've seen the movie, you know exactly what I mean. Well, that's all for me for now. As always, take care. Don't eat that glow-in-the-dark yogurt if you find it in your fridge. And I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.